Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, the place where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And I am so glad that we are probably the only interview place that has pre-interviews with guests and researchers to look into them because, man, I'm looking at my notes here on this interview from the team. And we've got weapon sales coming up in this interview. We've got entrepreneurial depression that nearly led to suicide in this interview. We've got partner issues, the kind of stuff that people need to know about. And eventually, we've got a real business with millions in sales and many happy customers. And I love this kind of story. And frankly, I shouldn't say this kind of story. I've never had an interview with this kind of story. This is definitely unique. The founder you're about to meet, his name is Saad Juman. He is the founder of Policy Medical. They make software that allows healthcare professionals to spend more time with their patients and less time with all the administrative tasks that they're forced to put up with. That's what they do. That's what he's built up. And this whole interview is sponsored by the company that will help you hire your next great developer. It's called TopTal, and the company that will help you finally get on the phone with people or see them in person because it's great for scheduling. It's called Acuity Scheduling. I'll tell you more about them later. First, Saad, man, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
What kind of revenue are you guys generating at Policy Medical?
We're between $7 to $10 million. We're privately held, so I've got to give those ranges.
Profitable?
Profitable. Highly profitable.
Highly profitable. Impressive. And before we get into the weapons thing, why don't we get into the DJ thing? How did you become a DJ?
Became a DJ because I found my way into university. I'm in Canada, so we call everything university. So I found my way in post-secondary education, and I loved music at that time, and I needed a way to pay my tuition. So I started DJing a couple of parties. I was pretty good at it. And then at that time, I became a pretty popular DJ, and that led to sort of the next step in that evolution of that world.
And one of the things you realized as an entrepreneur is, hey, you know what? I'm promoting, and because I'm getting a promoter, and the promoter's making a lot of money, maybe I could do that, right?
Yeah, the entrepreneurial bug that was really planted in me as a young teen or tween, if you will, by my mother, sort of surged again at that time of my life, and yeah, I said, you know what? Why am I being a DJ when the promoter pays me? So I became the promoter. Those events became very, very large. And I remember I was counting cash at the end of the night, as promoters do, at 2-3 o'clock in the morning in a kitchen of the venue. And my head of security, because we had to hire a head of security to take care of the lineups and all the stuff, he just said, he goes, you know what, you should just have your own venue. And I thought, I should have my own venue. And I kind of locked into that thought. And about a year and a half later, with a few partners, we ended up with our own venue in Toronto.
How much did you pay in rent?
Oh, this is a long time ago. What did we
pay? I'm just getting a sense of scale here from that.
Yeah, it probably costs about, I think it's 10,000 to 12,000 Canadian dollars per month. Yeah.
Okay. And did you have a bar and everything?
Yeah, it was a full, it would be categorized as a nightclub, differentiating factor. Toronto is a cold place. So we built one of the first large scale rooftop patios. So okay. That was a big draw at that time in the summertime.
All right. And somehow this led into what?
Well,
how do I put this? The weapons part.
The weapons part was really a byproduct of what I was surrounded with in that world. So the first year or so, it was great. You know, a guy in his early 20s, much older now, you're making money, you're surrounded by members of the opposite sex. It's great. And then you start learning about, at least in the 90s, early 2000s, around there, why those places exist. And I realized there's an underbelly, an underworld that's really connected to that particular world. And I started to get to know them. They made it a point to get to know me. And I don't look like them, right? So I don't look like them
at
all.
You're not white.
I'm not Caucasian. I don't ride a motorcycle.
I see.
You know, I don't, you know, I, you know, I.
But you're saying that, so I've obviously been to clubs a lot. I thought the whole thing was maybe drugs underneath and definitely people just trying to get laid. But you're saying, hey, underneath is another underneath, and that's people who are doing illegal things much more than that. And for you, it was people in a motorcycle gang. Am I right?
Yeah. Yes. And some of it's actually pretty comical at times, you know, even in the daytime, right? I mean, and it may have changed. My experience is my experience at that particular time, but I would show up to my club and some of my partners, they would have like all of these racks of clothes just inside of the club. And I'd ask, where do these clothes come from? And the answer is, you know, it kind of fell off of a truck. And by the end of the day, it would be shipped out into wherever it needed to go. So it was really a transit point for lots of things.
Okay.
At that particular point.
And did you help move weapons? Did you sell them?
I was involved in the organization that moved them. I was very, very good at running the nightclubs. So they knew that. I don't drink, don't smoke, don't do anything, right? So I had a straight head to keep track of everything. And in that world, I was known as a genius, even though, you know, I almost failed. I mean, my grade 11 high school math class, right? But I struggled in calculus in university. But in that world, I was a genius, so I could keep track of a lot of numbers, a lot of spreadsheets.
But you were the front.
I was the front, yeah.
And they would then, your partners would get to sell the stuff.
Yeah.
How'd you find these partners?
Some of them I knew growing up, ironically. Right. And that's how I got introduced to some of them. And then you learned who protected certain turfs, certain blocks, certain neighborhoods within where you operated. So back then, that's how it worked. If you had a venue, it wasn't just good enough to have a venue. You had to have the protection around you to protect you while you have that venue. And part of that protection is letting them do what they need to do.
Why are you talking about this now? I mean, you're a guy who runs a medical business or medical software business. Why are you opening up about this? And you knew I was going to ask you about it because we talked about it even before the interview started. I'm just surprised that you'd be willing to get into this. And I'm appreciative, but why?
You know what? It's my truth, right? So Policy Medical, which is our software company, it's in its 16th year. 16th year, right?
Yep.
And it's been a great education for me. But the last 2 years I've started, or two and a half, started talking about this because I want entrepreneurs to know that it's okay to just freaking be real. You know, you don't have to put on this certain persona that's not real to carry out your business. And I also want the broader population to know that if one person like myself could walk away from something that wasn't really them, wasn't for them, and try to restart something with just hope and faith and whatever else comes with it, it's possible. It's possible.
Are you afraid? Are you Muslim?
I am.
Are you afraid as a dark-skinned Muslim man having this be out there on the internet about weapon sales in the world as it is today? Did I just put the fear of that into you?
No, I've thought about this, even coming on to a podcast like this, and yep. It came up actually in another interview a little while ago. I would be lying to you if I said a part of me wasn't afraid, right? Because it's such a very weird political climate in this, you know, even, you know what? I don't know if you want to edit this out, but up until yesterday, I hate shaving. I just hate how shaving feels. And this is relevant because I went for a hike last night with my wife on our date night. So we live out in the wilderness here. So we're hiking. And I said, you know what? I've got this podcast tomorrow and I'm going to be on there. And I had this big beard, right? Last night, because I just don't shave unless... And she said, you get the podcast. What else is going on this week? And I said, I'm giving this keynote speech at this entrepreneur thing in Toronto on Thursday night. And she said, who's the audience? And I said, I don't know, Mixergy. I think the audience is like this, entrepreneurs, blah, 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 especially in the United States, probably.
Yep.
And the entrepreneur thing is this. And she said, yeah, you should probably shave. And the decision to shave actually is because of what you're hitting at. Because
so
if
that
I came on,
you don't look like a suspicious dark skinned guy who's sold weapons in the past and could potentially scare the audience.
Yes, I don't look
I
like a.
So you're saying
I
as much
like
as you want to be open and honest and tell people that's the way to live, you even battle with it yourself and need to figure out where that line is.
Yes. Yes.
I get it.
Yeah.
All right. Did you make any money from the weapons?
Made lots of money.
You did. How much? We're talking about weapons. What, guns? Something else?
Well, I made lots of money from that world, right? Okay. So my direct income was derived from the nightclubs, okay. Right? Part of my deal being there is keeping track of all the stuff. So when I walked away by asking to leave because the exit interview, right? There's no buyouts. There's nothing. Like, you have to ask permission to leave that world. So they were fine, the people I was surrounded with. But one thing I chose to do, which I think allowed me to leave free and clear, is to give up my stash, right?
All so your we money. All
my money.
What yeah. the? Really?
Yeah.
So yeah. you take on the risk of being associated with all this, and you don't even get to walk away with the money. How much money did you give up?
Close to the revenues of my company.
So we're talking about millions of dollars in cash you gave up?
Yes. Yes.
You literally had millions in the bank.
There's no bank in that world.
In a safe deposit box?
In a few Adidas gym bags.
At home. Millions, literally.
Yes.
And you didn't drink? Did you have sex?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. And you know what?
Did you get to enjoy any of this stuff? Or were you a goody two-shoes who had to run the books and didn't get to touch the money and didn't get drunk, didn't get laid, didn't get any of that?
No. I mean, I had relationships. I had girlfriends. You know, okay. there's even a point in time where, you know, my partners would be like, you know, you're so stuck up. You need to drink something. So I tried like all those different types of alcohol and none of it was for me. So sometimes I would drink or sometimes I would do what they taught me, which was the shoulder toss. You buy me a shot. We cheers. You look away. I toss it over my shoulder.
I've done that. I've done it on the floor. Like I take a sip and then I kind of drip it down so that it touches the floor. Right. And then no one looks because if it's down there, as long as I'm not dripping on your foot, it's fine. But the thing that I did something just like you. I didn't like alcohol, but I kept going to events where you needed to drink. And I went to a bar in New York in Midtown that was empty. And I said, I want you to give me one of every one of the popular drinks. And I'm going to taste each one of them and figure out which one I can deal with. And I remember it must have been a few hundred bucks for Midtown drinks, but it was worth it. I walked out with, I think it was like scotch and soda that I ended up with. By the way, speaking of drinks, I've got to acknowledge what I'm about to drink here because it's going to look a little weird on camera. One of my longtime fans and members created this evil energy drink. I told him that I'm tired because I got kids that I'm taking care of at night, you know, wake up in the middle of the night, new baby, and I'm also working a lot. And this is his energy drink, so I'm going to try it. It's going to make this drink, this water, a little purple. How do I know this is true? Let me ask you that question. How do I know that this is true? I can't check in with anyone. Is that a jerky question for me to ask?
No, it's any question is a fair question, right? I mean, I guess you never know if it was true, right? I mean, if you knew anybody in that world, you know, the way it works is, I mean, there's certain streets when I go on a date night with my wife, I don't even walk on anymore. Simply because, not for safety, I just don't want to see those people. And
what's one thing that only you would know because you were on the inside?
I know who all the dirty cops are.
Who all the dirty what?
Cops are.
Cops. I see. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's not enough, but I get it. I'm with you on this. Frankly, here's why I'm with you on this. You don't have that much to gain from talking about this. This really doesn't help your business. You're not like a long time blogger, podcaster who's going to get more street cred from this. And you have a business and frankly, makes for a good story. So I'm in with you on that. Why did you decide to leave instead of keep the money? And we'll get into what happened next.
You know what? I have two people to probably credit for that. So I grew up not with my father around. So we didn't have much of a relationship. We still don't have. It's if we go deep into my issues, that's a pretty deep issue. So,
father issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So while I was at one of my clubs one night, my father just showed up. He would visit once a year or so. So he showed up in Toronto, doesn't live in Toronto, showed up in Toronto with some of his buddies. I see him. I have him. He sits down in a little booth and they're enjoying that night. That night we get busted. And the police were surveilling some of our partners, but they busted us not for anything heinous or dramatic. They busted us on a technicality of the liquor license of that venue. So they came in right when the night had started, turn on all the lights, very cordial, not arresting anybody, saying, hey, here's a violation, blah, blah, blah. We're going to remove all the alcohol from the club. So they spent 45 minutes or something removing it all, putting it in this paddy wagon out in the parking lot. And then they said, hey, have a nice night, guys. Good luck with the night. And then you went to nightclubs. What happens if somebody takes all the alcohol away? Even if you don't, you know, even if you're out with your buddies, they're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So the club emptied out. My father said, hey, you know, can we chat? We went up to my office and we had like a 30 to 120 second conversation because at the closeness just wasn't there. It still is kind of being bridged even to this day. And he just said, he goes, you know what, Saad, this life isn't really for you. It's not who you are. You can't have a family life. It's not your nature. And that was like an arrow that went like straight inside of me. And it was ironically the criminals that I was surrounded with. When I would see keys of certain types of drugs or tons of pills of other things, right? Or all these stolen cars in a warehouse, I would get enthralled with like, I wonder what that's like. And the minute those guys also became like my big brothers, my protectors. They wouldn't allow me to partake or even try any of that stuff in a lot of ways.
I see.
So when my own father came along and said that, I started feeling really, really, really weird.
I see. That even if these criminals know that you're not part of their world and your dad, who you're not with every day, says the same thing, at some point you're seeing it from lots of different angles. People who see you on a daily basis, people who don't, people who know you from work, people who know you from birth. I get it. All right. And you said, I'm out. All right. And the thing that you then moved on to is software.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. And what were you doing in software?
Well, I moved first before I did that. I moved back home. So I gave up all that stuff. I moved back home actually with my mother, right? In a little place called Scarborough, Ontario, which is a suburb of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And I'm there. And you already mentioned that I'm Muslim. So I grew up actually going to one of the first mosques in Toronto. So I went back to the mosque and I asked the caretaker after the prayers were done that night if I could just stay in the mosque for that night. And he knew who I was because I grew up there. So he let me stay there that night.
Meaning overnight?
Overnight.
He's letting you just sleep in his place overnight. Not yeah. his place, but in the mosque overnight.
Yeah, he knows me from when I'm like a little okay. tiny
and
kid.
And what are you right? going to do overnight in the mosque?
So I didn't pray at that time. I didn't really practice any kind of religion. I just sat in the mosque in the open area. And I just started like asking without words for some kind of second chance, like show me some guidance. And I did that for 10 months. I would go back almost every single night and do the same thing and do the same thing and do the same thing. And I don't know, you can call me crazy, but at like month 3 or 4, it became like a two-way conversation, right? Where something greater than me told me that, hey, you know what? If you're going to get a second chance, your purpose is to make people, to try to impact their health, to try to impact their happiness.
Okay.
So I kind of locked in on that thought. And then one thing led to another in a few crappy startups. And I ended up in a really crappy startup in Toronto, being part of the sales team, selling healthcare intranets. These were like intranet solutions for hospitals where they post like meatloaf is in the cafeteria this today and all the other information. And that's where I got the idea for what's now known as Policy Medical.
And the reason that you had the idea, it was they were telling you, your customers as a salesperson, your customers were telling you they wanted what?
So the customers of that company at that time, they were pretty much calling up when we were able to sell it and say, hey, we needed to do this. And this was the same thing, which was they needed it to manage the hospital's policies and procedures.
Because what was the problem? I've got, just as I have everything else in the notes here, what I'm seeing here in my notes from our team's conversation with you is you began to notice a customer need that was being unmet. It was that need that made you say, there needs to be a better solution. What was that need? And how did they express it to you?
Well, the need was specifically in the United States. So the US hospitals found us first. I think it was right around when Google AdWords started. So we used that to get in contact with them. And they said, the need is because we have tons of regulations, bylaws from the Center for Medicare Services. There's another organization in the US called the Joint Commission. So all of these things they have to stay abreast of, they need to keep track of it. And they write policies at the hospital level to follow all that stuff. But they have no way of tying in the regulation to the policy. So I thought, oh, okay. So there's an opportunity here to build a document management system. There's tons of them out there, but build a document management system that syncs up the policies to the regs. And that was the origin point of the software. It's evolved from there over 16 years, obviously, but that was the initial need.
Okay. You took that back to the CEO of the company, and let's hold that thought and we'll see what he said. But first, I've got to tell people about one of my sponsors. It's a company called Acuity Scheduling. Saad and I used it to, frankly, book this interview. He and I connected. I'm looking here at one of my pieces of software. It was maybe about a month ago, 70 days ago, exactly to this day, is when we put you in our system. And we work hard to research you first, make sure that this company is legit, to make sure that as much as we can, we understand you before we have you on Mixergy. And considering all the work that we put in, we don't want to lose you the way we used to in the past by sending you a potential date for an interview. And then you come back and say, I'm busy that day. Then we come back and blah, blah, blah. We've done that. We've done a lot of work with guests in the past and we lost them. We didn't get the interview because we made it just a little too hard for them to actually pick a time and book the interview. Then someone on my team, a guy named Bob Heiler, an advisor and mentor of mine, said, hey, Andrew, did you know there's a piece of software called Acuity Scheduling? I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. What does it do? And he said, you just connect your calendar to it. You pick the dates when you're free to do interviews, and then you get this URL that you can give to guests and they pick the dates that they want that fits within your calendar. I said, yeah, but what happens if my wife schedules a lunch with me or if there's another meeting? Goes, just put in your calendar, and then Acuity reads your calendar and knows, don't book Andrew for an interview on that day. I said, sold. So I went to Acuity. I signed up. I figured out that I could actually also ask guest questions, their name, their phone number, that kind of thing, and that I could embed it on my site. So I did. I embedded it on my site. So now when someone wants to do an interview, I could send them a simple URL that lets them book with me and I get all their data and they get a calendar link that puts my interview on their calendar so they remember. I've done now hundreds of interviews with Acuity Scheduling, over 1,000 probably. I think I maybe have 5 to 10 people in the 1,000 who forgot about the interview. So I'm here, lights on, I'm ready to go. They're here too, and we're not wasting each other's time. That's really powerful. Now, I know you're not doing interviews, but you probably, if you're listening to me, trying to get customers on the phone, potential customers on the phone, trying to onboard people, right? Get your salespeople to actually talk to the people that they're selling to. Well, if you want to use the same tool we have, you've got to go check out Acuity Scheduling. It'll integrate with all the software you use, not just through Zapier, though Zapier is available, but all the other apps that you use are connected there. So as soon as someone books, you can also add them to your CRM. You can also get your team moving on them. Anyway, I think the best way for you to check it out is to actually try it. And the best way for you to try it is to go try it for free using the special URL. Here it is. AcuityScheduling.com/Mixergy. Acuity is spelled A-C-U-I-T-Y. AcuityScheduling.com/Mixergy. Oh, they're even throwing a private one-on-one consultation with someone on the team. So they will help you use this right and get the results you're looking for. All right. Saad, coming back to your story from the ad, you went to the CEO of your company and you said, here is a need. It is unmet. And the CEO said,
go back to your cubicle. Sell what we have.
You know, the because funny he didn't want to get involved in another business, right?
Well, his business was raising money from the angel they had, right? Which is an older gentleman that built a cookie empire, right? So they were just getting rounds of funding from this individual at that time. So I just left, and I'm not a developer, so I don't know how to code, but I can draw on a whiteboard. So I asked the head developer. I said, you know what? Let's leave. Let's leave and start this thing.
Two of you, 50-50 partnership, starting this business together.
Yeah, we were 50-50.
And we're going to get into what happened because that's another issue. This is one of the biggest challenges for entrepreneurship. I think it was Paul Graham from Y Combinator who said that's one of the biggest reasons why Y Combinator-funded companies break apart. All right, but you wanted to make sure that you actually were on the right track. What did you do while he was coding up the solution?
We tried Google AdWords, which...
To try to get somebody to like... potentially buy this thing that didn't exist so you can call them up and understand why they wanted to buy it. Am I right?
Exactly.
Okay. And did that work for you?
It worked. I think what still worked back then, which I still believe is needed today, but much less, is cold calling. So it's and I was my background professionally within my career at that time was a technology sales guy. So I was well versed in cold calling. And we had this thing called the Hospital Blue Book, which is like a phone book for every hospital in the United States. So I would call, I'd make 100 to sometimes 150, 200 calls a day, as much as I could, to look for people that are looking for our software.
What would you say your hit rate was when you're calling them up to actually get someone on the phone and talk to you about what software should be?
You know what? I feel like the answer's always been the same. It's 10%.
10%? That's high, frankly.
Well, you make 100 calls, you're going to get 10 people that'll say, yeah, you know what? Send me an email. Sounds vaguely interesting. Now, out of that 10, you'll get 5 that'll say, show me the thing. Out of the 5, you'll get 2 or 3 that'll say, yeah, you know what? I think I'm going to buy. And then you'll get 1 or 2 that'll actually buy. So as you dwindle it down, it's 1 to 2%. But the initial hit ratio of having a pulse right away is 10%.
you know what? I've tried the whole Google AdWords thing to get people on the phone, because that's what Tim Ferriss said in the 4-hour work week worked for him, right? That's also what Eric Ries talked about in Lean Startup. And I asked Eric Ries in one of his later interviews with me about that. And he said, you know what? It's true. AdWords, AdSense, it's just not going to work the way that it used to, but you need to find new ways. I think that the way that you're talking about, just picking up the phone and calling, is probably the best, because you're hearing the frustration in people's voice. You're getting a sense immediately if they're into it. But most people are afraid of doing it. Most people don't know how to do it right. And I've tried it too with some of the people in my audience. It's a challenge to get people on the phone. What do you do to actually get a 10% hit rate and to actually get results? What do you do based on, what did you do based on your sales experience?
I think it's law of averages. Really, law of averages.
You're saying just, you don't do anything special. You just are willing to sit and make 100 phone calls where most people will punk out of 5.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's no, I'm not the best salesperson out there. There's no secret sauce. Right. And I still, to this day, I mean, so now the company's grown. So we have people, we have a chat thing that comes up and people chat, and then the sales guy will be there and he'll call them back. So that's all good. But you know what drives me nuts? Even when I mentor, I advise other startups, is if you're like my business, the list of people you could possibly sell to is pretty small. We're selling to like 5,600 accredited hospitals in the United States. Out of those 5,600, we got a couple thousand specific people I want to talk to. So just, I'm old school. Just get to them. Just pick up the phone and get to them, email them, figure out a way.
What'd you do to hold yourself accountable and stay on track? I interviewed one entrepreneur who used to put a stack of quarters on the left side of his desk, and then every time he made a phone call, he moved one coin to the right side until the stack moved all the way over to the right side of his desk. And that's how he knew that he was making enough phone calls and not punking out. What did you do? It seems like you had some process.
I think it was that discipline was already drilled into me by the time I got there. One of my older brothers, he had a tech company that I worked at. That's how I learned to sell since I was 17 years old. And his company was a lead generation company for other tech companies. So I knew how to cold call. I knew how to do that whole Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross, whatever, boiler room stuff, right? I knew how to get down.
Do you have any tips for us based on that? I don't want to go through your whole experience to get the lesson. I want to actually get it from you, get that shortcut.
I think, you know what? I think you should know your freaking industry really, really well and know your product. I think those two things, at many sales and marketing people, they try to still come up with like the right thing to say or the right technique. But if you can, if you generally know your product and your industry better than who you're calling, then you can actually teach them something on the phone. My goal has always been, when I get off the phone or I walk out of a boardroom, they almost feel like they should have paid me for that time.
Why? What? I see. What was in it for them? What for getting on the phone with you? How would they even know that you had something to teach them?
They wouldn't, right? They actually wouldn't. But by me getting the right person on the phone, and I would tell them, I'd say, you know what? Are you dealing with such and such a pain? Yeah. And you're probably also
that's
doing
what I mean.
This.
What's that such and such a thing that they were dealing with that you knew and you could help them think through?
So if I got the person that was managing all these documents on the phone, right? It's usually a her. So I know it's a her. I'm not being sexist here. I just know my demographic. I get her on the phone. I would say, you know what? You're probably managing an Excel spreadsheet that probably has X amount of rows. Yeah, I am. And you're probably trying to get all the other executives to update the document too, but they're not paying you any attention. Yeah. And probably the hospital probably has a lawsuit or a claim of this size, and then it comes back to you. Yeah. So once I'm proving that I know her world and her pain. And then I say, you know what? We're working on this thing. And then, but back then it was really hard because everybody wanted a reference. They're like, okay, this is great. Now give me a reference. We didn't have any references, but we had one customer that managed to give us a break.
What did you learn from all these phone calls?
Persistence.
What did you learn about the product or the need because of the phone calls that you didn't know before, having walked in knowing so much?
Oh, it was so valuable because I didn't know everything. So every phone call, every email exchange, it would help us to refine and craft the product further and further and further.
They would send us,
I remember Champlain Valley Physicians Hospital in Plattsburgh, New York, still a customer of ours. They ended up sending us a requirements definition spreadsheet that itemized every single thing a piece of software has to have. I literally took that document, went to Josh, my co-founder, and I said, dude, build this, right? And that's really what we did. And we started getting, and then I knew that, oh, there's these things called requirement spreadsheets. So So when we're dealing with a demo or a prospect, I'd say, do you have a requirement spreadsheet? Yeah, we do. Take it, figure out what we don't have, tell Josh to build it. It was that simple.
That's really powerful. And did you get that first customer that you started to mention? Did you get them on board at all before you started? Before you built or before you launched?
We got them on board when we're still in the prototype phase, right? So, and I was honest. Honesty got them on board because the CIO, Chief Information Officer, I believe she's still there at that hospital. She said, I feel like we'd be your first customer. And I just told her, I said, I think your feeling is correct. And she said, well, can you give me a break in the price? I said, yep. She goes, well, what's it going to cost? And I just made up a price back then. And it was a very, very low price. And they still pay that same price today.
I see. Because they grandfathered into that price and they're so close to the company 16 years later. Wow. Yep. But I have this understanding, having done these interviews, where if you approach a customer who has such a deep pain that they're waiting, that they're thirsty, hungry for a solution, they will talk to you, give you feedback, help you build the product, and even settle for an unfinished product just because their pain is so deep that they need you to build it. They want you to get good at it. Am I right that that's what was going on here? That there was that kind of deep pain in the industry?
You're right about that. And that was at the early adopter phase, right? So we were getting the early adopters that sensed the pain, that knew how valuable the stuff was. And they gave us those breaks.
Can you tell me more about the pain as they experienced it? Why was it so bad that they were willing to take a call from a stranger and work with you and accept a half-baked solution?
Well, their reality is very, very stressful. So back at that time, within the healthcare world, new titles started surfacing to help deal with this at the hospital. So you'd have these compliance professionals. So a compliance professional, they're in charge of making sure the hospital complies to everything they need to. But what would be happening to these poor people is they would be following these regulations and they'd have these inspectors, they're called surveyors, that would show up to the hospital to survey if they're following the rules or not. Now, the surveys we learn are unannounced. So basically, they have to be in a perpetual state of readiness at any given time because a surveyor could show up at any time of the year to survey them.
And by the way, just to give people clarity on the kind of policy that they had to comply with, you gave our producer the example of scalpels needed to be disinfected after surgery, right? And so this is something that they could then be inspected on, if I'm understanding you right, and it could happen at any time. So this was, I could see the stress that goes along with that. How are you helping them get through that? What was it that you were going to do?
So from a very simple, basic level back then, it's changed now, but back then, if a nurse needed to get to a policy, let's use a different example. Let's say they're getting sued because somebody slipped and fell in the lobby of the hospital and broke their leg. So they're now in a court case and they need to prove that a nurse at any given time could get to the fall prevention policy. Even that alone was a disaster for most hospitals because the nurse would have to go to a bookshelf, pull out a binder, find the fall prevention policy. A healthy amount of the time, they're finding the wrong policy, an out-of-date policy, or no policy. Hospital loses court case, they have to pay out. So now with a piece of software, they're able to get to the right version at the right time.
I see. And that's the solution that you were offering them, and how? And that's the big problem that you were identifying for them. I see. And then the first version, you told our producer, took you guys 9 months to create, to get to a shippable point. How much of the solution that you just described was available in that first one, and what was missing that only an early adopter would be willing to put up with?
At first, it was essentially a file sharing solution, which when I was demoing, I was the sales guy at that time, I was selling much more than that. I was selling the potential of what's to come. So some of the things that were missing were what they would call version control. How do we keep track of all the different versions of the document? Another big thing that was missing was proper workflow collaboration. So if we're in different parts of the United States, how do we collaborate on a document from different places? Remember back then, there was no box.net. There was no Dropbox. There was no Office.
I was going to say, basically you were selling them a crippled version of Google Drive. And don't get me wrong, Google Drive was a crippled version of Google Drive back then too. Or
yes.
It didn't even exist, if I remember right. I see. So you gave them a place to put their documents and search their documents, and that was essentially it. And what was missing was the ability to collaborate on their documents. What was missing is all the other stuff that you said. But because it was such a big problem that you were addressing, they were willing to put up with that.
Yes.
Okay. All right. How long did it take you to get profitable, to pay yourselves?
We were pretty simple. You know, even when I talk to other entrepreneurs these days and they tell me about minimum viable product, and I don't understand these things. So it sounds like they're just trying to build some crap to get funding. So for us, it was so beautiful and simple back then. I remember the first purchase order for that hospital in Plattsburgh, New York, came in this big, huge fax machine in our office. Our office, by the way, was my mom's basement. So it came into that fax machine, and it was for $9,995. That's the price. We just made it up. We didn't know how to price software, right? And we knew that there had to be a recurring amount, which back then you charge 15 to 22% of that. So we just charged them $1,200 a year, which in retrospect almost crippled us later on, because we realized we have all these customers, but they're on this old perpetual model and our recurring revenue was really, really low. So we had to switch to subscription. But that's a whole chasm we had to cross. But back then, $10,000 came in. We put it in the bank. I'd say, Josh, here's five for me. That was our mindset back then. It was very, 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 very simple.
One of the big mistakes that you made was you and Josh just got started. Was there an agreement to the partnership?
No, this is like one of the biggest things I feel people don't pay attention to at the onset of a venture. And it leads to massive deterioration.
By the way, this is what I'm glad that you're talking about. Sitting, now that I moved here to San Francisco, I've been here now 4 years or so, going to dinner with friends, this topic comes up all the time, but people don't talk about it publicly because they're, I think, a little too afraid of hurting someone else's feelings, when in reality, both partners are willing to talk about it and they're willing to put up with someone saying the wrong things about them because they're just okay with it. I'm glad that you're talking about it. Tell me what happened.
So I think the time to do this is early days, like just when you start, not when things go wrong. So when we started, we incorporated, we got things set up. I think our second lawyer in, the first guy that did it, he just set up our articles of incorporation, I guess is what you call it. And then the first real lawyer we had, which is still our lawyer today, he said, you know what, you guys should have a shareholders agreement or a partnership agreement. And we said, nah, it's fine. It's going to be fine. You know, I'm going to sell. He's going to build software. It's going to be good. And then later on, and I have nothing bad to say about my co-founder, right? If anything, I just have sadness and guilt about what I did, because we both, I think, are to blame for what ended up happening.
So why did you guys break up then?
We both decided, you ever read The E-Myth by Michael Gerber?
Yeah.
Like that, right? So that book ended up happening, you know, the Apple Pie, which is, imagine we had an Apple Pie company. The Apple Pie was the policy management software. So as the business grew, there were more roles to be had.
Yep.
Taking care of the finances, hiring people, marketing, sales, all the other stuff. And I naturally started taking on more and more of that type of stuff. And we both got to a point where we said, you know what? One of us has to leave. And I said, it's not going to be me. And he said he wanted to leave. So that's where it was. That was good, because he's also the type of guy, he's more of a chilled out guy, right? So we decided to leave. But what ended up happening is another company found out that we were deciding to part ways. And that company kind of got in between both of us and started whispering to both of us. And I was pretty firm saying, no, let's go with what we agreed on. And that company started saying, well, you know what? If you both sell us the company, we'll pay you this, right?
And you didn't want to sell. He did, I'm imagining?
Yeah, he wanted to sell to that other company. I didn't want to sell to the other company. Because I knew there's this thing called due diligence. And just because they're giving us a figure, once they do due diligence, that could easily change. And plus, I was enjoying the ride. Policy Medical has been the best education for me so far.
Let me tell you something also. I think you'll agree with this. I feel like a lot of companies do due diligence as a way of kind of sweating you down. You get distracted as a business. Your heart isn't in running the business anymore. You're almost imagining yourself on an island. And then they come back and they say, here are a few flaws that we discovered. And as a result of that, we have to give you a lower price. And what are you going to do at that point? You're already on the island mentally. Your business is already starting. All right. You're nodding. I see. Let me take a quick moment to tell people, look, one of the reasons why Saad actually partnered up with someone was he needed a developer. A lot of people are looking for great, phenomenal developers. And as a result, they're willing to do anything, spend days, weeks, days is nothing, months, years, sometimes finding the right developer or giving up equity to someone who they're not sure that they're ready to give up equity to. But they're desperate to find the right developers, because in software, It's a developer that matters. It's a developer that really will create this great product that people are going to be willing to pay for. Well, there's another way. And the other way is TopTal. There's a reason why Andreessen Horowitz invested in them. This is the future of hiring developers. TopTal said, we're going to find a network of the best developers out there. We know what it takes to find the right developer. That is going to be our focus as a business. We are going to be in the business of screening them, and we know that the best developers like a really challenging screening process so that they could get to the end of it and feel proud of having been accepted into the network. And so that's what they created. TopTal put this network together of the top 3% developers, and they said, great. Now, any business that needs to hire developers can come to us, and often within days, we could find them the right part-time, full-time, sometimes it's even a whole team of developers to go into their team and to go into their company and help create the best software possible. That's what TopTal is about. Many people that I've interviewed have gone and hired from them because they're such a good company. If you want to go check them out, I'm going to give you the same deal that they're offering every other Mixergy person and nobody else. The deal that they're giving us, because it's created by two longtime Mixergy fans, is if you're a listener, you're going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. So that's basically the equivalent of two full work weeks for free when you work with them. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. So they're covering your risk completely. And my sense is they're losing money on you in the beginning because they know that if they can make you happy and they could show you how great it is to work with TopTal, you're going to want to work with them into the future and tell your friends about them. So here's the URL. Go to toptal.com/Mixergy. That is top as in top of the mountain, tal as in talent, toptal.com/Mixergy. And be sure to look at that really very attractive model on the right side of this of the page on toptal.com/Mixergy. All right, so you decided not to sell. He wanted to sell. You have no agreement. Saad, how did you clear it up?
It ended up coming down to lawyer communication. And
he hired a lawyer. You stopped talking to each other, and that was it.
Yeah. It was horrible. And then we ended up going to mediation, and it took a 1 business day mediation session. To figure it out. At one point, I got up in there and I just told him, I addressed him. I said, you know what? The only people making a lot of money today, right, are all these advisors and lawyers we have around us. But anyways, I think we both got to a valuation of the company that we both were unhappy with, and I think that was probably a good thing.
How much did he get for the part of the business he had?
$250,000.
$250,000. And this was how long ago?
It's 2009.
Okay. So we're talking about a significant amount of time ago. Today, you're doing more than that a year in profit.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you guys still talk at all?
You know what? I mean, I just got to be real in all of these interviews I do. I would love to talk to him, right? He's just not ready yet, right? I think my only way of contacting him is through LinkedIn. I tried. He did get back to me. He said, you know what? Not yet. So I just
he said
it
not
that.
Yet.
Yeah, he said not yet.
All right.
For nothing else other than just mending it, saying sorry. At the end of the day, business is just business, right? It's he's a guy that I always liked, right? I have nothing but respect for him. So if we can mend things before we leave, then that's good.
Meaning before you die.
Yeah.
Speaking of dying, at the top of the interview, I think I mentioned that there was depression. Again, another issue that entrepreneurs deal with that they talk about in private, but they don't mention to other entrepreneurs outside of their little friendship circle. Let's talk about this this experience you had in a hotel room in, was it Oklahoma?
Yes, Norman, Oklahoma.
What were you doing in Norman, Oklahoma, by the way?
I was saving the business. So that was a period of time.
What was going on in the business at the time that you needed to save it?
It was pretty much bankrupt on paper. At that evolution of the business, we neglected
when
product development. This was shortly after I bought Josh out, right?
So you bought him out, and then you guys are close to going out of business. You're essentially on paper bankrupt, meaning your debts are higher than your assets. That's not bankrupt. What made you guys?
We're on our way. Like our burn rate was going up. Our revenue model was really silly.
You were going to run out of cash, is what you're telling me.
We were going to run out of cash.
Got it. And then at some point, if you can't pay your people, you can't pay your expenses, you can't continue to run the business. Okay, why did you guys get to that point, considering how well the business was going from the beginning?
We neglected product development. So one thing with healthcare is it's very difficult sometimes to get that customer. But once you have that customer, your attrition rate, your churn is very, very low. I mean, I can probably count on both hands over 16 years the amount of customers we've lost. We took that for granted. We took our customers for granted that they're just going to keep on paying us. They're just going to keep on buying. And then the buying slowed down because competition entered. And we just didn't innovate our product. It was just average at that point. So what I was doing in Norman, Oklahoma is I went on the road for, this was right around when my first child was born. I was traveling, visiting every customer I could with a Moleskine, sitting with every decision maker saying, what do you think of us? The answer was always the same. Oh, you guys are good. But it wasn't like, oh, we can't do without you. So I asked, what would make us great? What's that stickiness? I'd write it down. So I was in Norman, Oklahoma.
You were asking them what would make you great? It wasn't, you were asking them basically to tell you how to improve your product, not what they wanted.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. And was it useful to ask that question? What would make us great? Is that something I should be asking?
That's what saved the company in my experience.
Okay.
They told us. They literally told us, you know what? Well, since you're asking, the product should do this and should do that.
What's an example of something they told you that you didn't know before, but actually made the product really great enough that they'd be willing to pay more for?
It needed to be healthcare specific. We were only healthcare specific by sales and marketing. The name of the company, we would say we're healthcare specific, but nothing with the actual product back then actually made it healthcare specific. So they wanted us to sign partnerships with the regulators, exclusive partnerships to start embedding the regulations within our actual application. They wanted us to have the Dropbox capability or the Office 365 capability. Figure out a way to do it. Don't just say you're going
to integrate in with the software they use, which is Office.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And at the time, it wasn't even Office 365, I don't think, but it was Microsoft Office.
It was Microsoft Office. So we ended up figuring all that stuff out once it was mapped out for us, right? And I started seeing the actual trends.
But before you actually got to that point, you were at that hotel in Oklahoma feeling depressed. And how close were you? What led you to think, I'm done? I think I've got to off myself.
It's the way I was abusing myself, right? As an entrepreneur, I would sleep 3-4 hours a night. Remember, I was traveling incessantly.
Yeah.
I barely drink coffee, even though I just drank one, but I barely drink coffee. So I was having about 7 cups of coffee a day. A couple of them were these Doppio espressos, double espressos from Starbucks. And it was just in a bad, bad place. And that night in Norman, Oklahoma, the thought came to me is, what if I just ended it all? It meaning my life.
I see.
What if I just ended it all and the gates of heaven didn't open? I didn't have an epiphany, but I stopped. And I asked myself, why the hell am I having this feeling? What the hell's going on? And I learned something at that point that I'm still trying to master. And if I could share one thing with whoever's listening to this, let's say this right hand of mine is me as a CEO of my venture. And then this is who I really am. I took those two identities and I mashed them together. So when the business was, in my perception at that time, failing, to my core, I felt like a freaking failure. Right.
Yeah.
And I vowed, I said, you know what? I need to separate this stuff. And I told myself, if one day the business is ever doing tremendously well, I'm still going to remember this because I need to deploy humility at all times because I shouldn't feel like a king if the business is doing well. So this is one thing I always tell my mentees, my entrepreneurship mentees, that you are you. The business is your business. I'm not saying separate personal and business. I don't believe in that, but it's a different thing. Your identity is different. And actually that allowed me to operate from a different place over the next several years to make different decisions in a very calm way.
I have to keep reminding myself of that. And I had that problem dramatically a long time ago because what happened was I was identifying myself with the business. And if the business sucked, then I sucked. Now, if I suck, how the hell am I going to fix the business? I can't because I suck. The only way I was able to figure that out was to separate, have a life outside of the business where I could do really well and feel really strong. And if I'm feeling really strong and the business sucks, then I can go and fix the business, right? As opposed to being in lockstep. And I guess that's what you're saying too. What's an example of something you were able to do once you came to that conclusion?
I started working on myself, right? I started figuring out, asking myself, who am I? What do I need to do? And how do I get the help, right? So I went to my family doctor, right? And so I'm being as real as I can because I want entrepreneurs that are listening to this to know that you shouldn't feel ashamed if you have these thoughts. I went to my general physician. I said, I had this thought. He said, did you have thoughts afterwards? I said, yeah, I did. Right.
Wow,
I feel very, very stressed out. Like, I feel like I'm a complete failure here. So then I tried psychotherapy, right? So I got a therapist. So it was a vehicle for me to just start talking about this stuff. Right. And I did that for several years. I was a martial artist, right? Since I was a little kid, I still teach little kids martial arts on the side for fun. But I thought, and I guess it was all the Kung Fu movies I saw growing up. I thought, you know what? You know, the Kung Fu guy in all those movies, he was a great fighter, but he was a healer as well. So I knew through my teachers, my masters growing up, that there was a healing side to those arts. So I embraced meditation. I started journaling, you know, those types of things to see what would work, to try to express what was inside of me to come out so I can start making sense of it.
I see. And what about this, though, that, sorry, I'm telling the guest who I'm supposed to talk to in like 3 minutes. I need more time with you. There, I just told him and he understands. The thing is, though, what you did seemed necessary. I have no idea what I would do if I were in your position. All these notes that you took while you were drinking your coffee and pushing yourself to the limit were actually helping. So shouldn't you continue like that? What happens when you stop doing all this stuff that works?
Well, it's working. Everything you mentioned is working for the business, right? It's not necessarily working for me. My son was at that point, you know, several months old. I'm not even seeing him at that point, right? I mean, I have four of them now, right, running around and a couple floors below me. But that's more important to me. You know, once Policy Medical is gone, you know, the one certainty, as Steve Jobs, I believe, said, is death. Okay, mm-hmm. So let's leave religion and everything out of it. We all know we're going to die. When at that last moment, I always remind myself on a daily basis, am I really going to care what my financial scorecard said this month? You know, I had the board meeting for the company just before this, actually. And am I going to care? I'm not going to care as much about it. It's the time with family, with friends, that type of stuff. That's just the way I'm wired. So I wanted to focus on that. And that whole saving the company stuff, it was necessary, but not at the expense of myself.
Okay. All right. So you took all those notes. You went back to the team. You now had the team all within your control, right? You didn't have a co-founder within your control, but also within your responsibility. You started building. Customers started coming in as a result of that?
Well, I realized that I didn't have what it took to evolve the product. I wasn't good enough. I didn't have the skill set. Mm-hmm. So I decided I needed a mentor or somebody to help show me that. So then I looked, and in Silicon Valley, I found a guy. We started off as mentor-mentee because he had built a company just like mine, bigger, exited, all that stuff. And then he started advising me on the product. And eventually, to cut a long story short, he came in, got awarded equity, and became, he's now my chief medical officer, which is a fancy word for head of product development for a healthcare company like mine. And he's the one that actually took all those notes. And we built this prototype in this thing called Xsure. I remember spending many, many nights with him, and we churned out this prototype of what the product could look like. And then we decided, well, it should be cloud-based, because before it was client-server. It was installed at every single hospital all over the place.
Oh, wow.
And that was
a
whole other journey.
Oh, good God. Right. I forget about how life was so much different 16 years ago.
Yeah, you'd have to go and install it in the server room next to the 8 air conditioning units and everything else. So we had to migrate the whole thing to Amazon Web Services.
This is Sanjaya Kumar. I'm looking him up to get a sense of who he is.
Yep. That's
one thing that I like about your site is you make it really easy to get to know the people behind the company. Like, you have your own interview on the site with everyone within the company. There's clear photo, clear description. All right. Congratulations on turning this around. I really like that this is something you're willing to talk about publicly. There's something about being in such a safe place in the world where your company's not about to die at any minute. You're doing well. You can actually take some time to tell us how you got here. And I really appreciate you doing that. As I've looked you up, I've discovered that you do talk publicly, but I think your SEO juice is really low. So it's hard to find your personal site, for example. I had to look it up and like go to the second page of Google for my just to find your website. But it's Saad Jumin,
yes,
which is not spelled like you'd think. But that's sadjuman.com is your personal website where people could connect with you. What's another way for someone who says, hey, you know what? Your story touched me. I happen to be, you're in Toronto right now?
I'm in Toronto, yeah.
They happen to be in Toronto. They want to connect. Is there a way for them to reach out to you?
You know, that's something I'm trying to figure out. And as you said, my SEO juice is low. My social media juice is low as well because I don't use a lot of those platforms very much, right? So as I talk and I speak, it's happening organically. But, you know, I'm trying to figure out what channel works for me. Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff doesn't work for me because I just don't use it as much.
I know you really need to have the time and the patience to do it. I stopped doing it for a while. And then someone on my team just said, hey, you know what, Andrew, I'm going to get on the phone with you every week and we're going to think through how we can push you to get back on social media. And so every week on Tuesday, I get together with someone and she says, come on, what's going on in your life? How about, why don't you talk more about that? All right. But you know what? Your email address, I'm going to give it out right now. It's sadjuman@gmail.com. If anyone wants to connect with you, that is your personal email address. Are you pissed that I just gave it out?
No, go for it.
All right. sadjuman@gmail.com. And sadjuman.com is your website. And I hope that as people get to know you, that they'll come back and tell me about their relationship with you. One of the things that I found here in doing these interviews is that there's some people who will, some entrepreneurs who are really good at reaching out to the people who I interview, and they get so much out of it. Both sides do. And I hope that'll happen from this interview. Frankly, the easiest win for anyone who's listening, who says, hey, I like Saad, I want to get to know him, is to say, Saad, I will help get more traffic to your, or not, you don't even care about traffic. I'll increase your SEO juice. Here's the plan. Here's what we're going to do. Cause that's a low hanging fruit for a guy who's way too busy to be able to do this on your own. All right. Saad, thanks so much for doing this interview.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
Me too. I've enjoyed getting to know you. The two sponsors are toptal.com/Mixergy and acuityscheduling.com/Mixergy. And I'm not really into energy drinks. I really have given them up. But I got to tell you, this evil berry thing that I'm drinking, I don't even know if I could call it an energy drink. I thought it would make my heart race as I talk to you, you know, like the way that Rockstar energy drinks and others do. It's not. It's just kind of like drinking juice. And I'm sure that I'm getting some kind of caffeine from it, but it's not like all at once. All right, that's I'm only mentioning it because it's created by someone in the audience, and I appreciate that he sent me. Look at how much he sent me. Look at this. Look at that. It's a lot. All right, Saad, thank you so much. Bye, everyone.